The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Are you making the most of your KiwiSaver investment? Generate is an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of strong long-term performance. Making a smart decision now could add tens of thousands of dollars by the time you reach retirement. Book a no-obligation chat with a Generate KiwiSaver advisor today at generatekiwisaver.co.nz/getadvice. A copy of the product disclosure statement is available at generatekiwisaver.co.nz. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited, and of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Kia ora and welcome to the Offspin for another month, I suppose. It's been a while since our last episode, and speaking of that last episode, we need to open this one with Simon Day making an apology to the nation of Bangladesh and all of its people. Simon, what exactly are you sorry for here?
I refuse to apologise. I didn't know the Bangladesh team was coming to New Zealand, and I barely know that they came.
Yeah.
Like, can you remember anything that happened in those six games? I do feel sorry for them, spending 2 weeks in an isolation to play six poorly games of cricket.
Yeah,
and lose them all
quite badly. Can I remember anything that happened in any of those games? That is a pretty brutal question to put me on the spot with. And
you were asking me to apologise.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that was Simon Day's apology for that, and I think he about summed up that series pretty well. So speaking more generally, we've got some very exciting news for the Offspin generally.
I'm proud of us.
I'm very proud of us, actually. I'm proud of our commercial team for making this happen, because we now have a sponsor. We are sponsored by The Beer Spot. They've got five sites across Auckland. They've got something like 40 independent New Zealand beers on their taps. They've got a whole lot of food trucks.
Fantastic, knowledgeable staff. You go in and tell them about your palate, and they'll line you up with something that you'll love.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, they gave us some beers to drink on this podcast. It is just ticked over past midday now, so it's acceptable. And when I went into the beer spot in Morningside, I said, oh, we're kind of looking for something that you could drink slowly over the course of a day sitting in the sun. And so they've given us a Keridu Lager.
And I've got a Liberty Liquor Brew Pilsner.
Yeah.
And I'll drink it now.
What's it like?
Delicious. Sharp, clean, floral notes.
Lovely.
Could drink this all day for 5 days.
Lovely, lovely. And we probably will when it comes to the World Test Championship. And given that Simon has a food podcast as well and plenty of opportunities to talk about beers that he likes on it, I'll just finish that up by saying The Beer Spot, thank you for sponsoring us.
They're in Huapai, Whangaparoa, Pāmunua, Northcote, and of course the mighty Morningside just around the corner from the spin-off.
Yep, they sure are. And we'll be checking that out a lot over the coming weeks, I'd say. And speaking of beer and cricket, everyone's favourite social media posting cricketer, Jimmy Neesham, has maybe fucked up a bit.
Well, he's posted a photo of himself, Trent Bolt, Scott Kugelein and Adam Milne in the background in the pool in India, all having a Corona beer.
Mm.
Might be an accident. If it's on purpose, it's definitely not funny.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose with something like this, if just for a bit of context right now, we're recording this on Tuesday, and, you know, it's been in the news for a couple of weeks now, but especially over the past couple of days, the COVID-19 situation in India is just absolutely disastrous. Delhi has run out of ICU beds. The case numbers have hit new records every day for about 5 days in a row now, I think. And in terms of doing a social media post like that, I mean, here's the thing. I kind of think of Jimmy Neesham as a pretty media-savvy cricketer. He's pretty aware of what he's doing. He's pretty aware of how the game works. And so I've got to assume that he must have realised that everyone having some coronas in the swimming pool while, like, the medical apocalypse is taking place outside of the walls of the hotel. You've got to assume that he must have known how that looked, right?
Without a doubt. And the comments under his photo, all 253 of them, you know, Indians love to engage with social media, have been pretty nonchalant about it. No one seems to have minded, but I don't know. It's just, it doesn't hit right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to not try and beat controversies out of quite innocuous social media posts. But it does, you know, it does put the situation for the IPL in context at the moment. It's an enormous international sporting event, a huge amount of money tied up in it, a huge amount of money for the players especially, and yet it is going on at a time when a pandemic is basically destroying the country. And we do have a strong precedent for pandemics forcing the postponement or closure of sporting events, and that was 2020.
We've got a lot of people already leaving the IPL, a lot of the international players. Ravi Ashwin has pulled out to go and spend time with his family.
Yep, and a couple of Australian players. At the time we're doing this, a couple of Australian players have pulled out, and there's a lot of speculation that that's because at the moment, travel from India is really tightening up again. I mean, at the moment, New Zealand citizens in India can't really get back
without
from India
right 3 weeks somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's an interesting time. I mean, by the time you listen to this podcast, the IPL might have been cancelled completely.
I've heard an interesting point that the IPL is what Indians need right now. Locked in isolation, something to do, something to take their mind off it. I don't know if that gives you permission to make Corona beer jokes. The jokes that I have enjoyed, though, have been in the comments under Jimmy's post saying that the shirtless Neesham, Bolt and Kugelein look like the in-betweeners having their first ever beer.
Owned. I love it.
They need to go in the weight room a bit more as well, I think.
Oh, that's a bit harsh.
Not great rigs.
Well, they're not Australian cricketer rigs, that's for sure.
But Alex, you know, Spray is actually not drinking. I'm having to drink for the pair of us because he's going to the gym after the recording of this. So.
Yeah. Just, I mean, I'm intending on taking one of these home.
All right.
Afterwards. Just speaking of how massive the IPL is in India, it, you know, as like an Indian cultural phenomenon as well, I'd like to bring in our guest here for the day, and I'll just do a brief bio of him. His name's Michael Appleton. He is a diplomat. He works for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. His last posting overseas was actually to India. And in a couple of months, he's going to be heading off to Sri Lanka to be the High Commissioner to Sri Lanka. And he's also the spin-off's chief cricket correspondent.
Chief statistician, the Francis Payne of the spin-off.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a title that he didn't ask for and is perhaps slightly surprised to be getting. But Michael, congratulations on cracking the media big time like that.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't know I was going to be given that honour today, but, you know, these things come and they come.
No one else wants it, and you sort of stepped into it.
All right, that's kind of you, mate.
Yeah, it's an unpaid sinecure, so, I mean, actually, I don't know if we pay you for your articles or not, but I hope we do, because they're very good, so... I'll just let that one go through to the keeper, I think. So, yeah, like I was saying, Michael, we know how important cricket is in India. I mean, that's something that's well understood. But specifically about the IPL, is there any insight that you can give us about the stature and the status of this particular tournament within cricket in India generally?
Yeah, I mean, I was quite surprised when experiencing my first IPL in India by how important it was to cricket fans there. Like, I kind of expected it to be something that was sort of a bit of light entertainment and that wouldn't reach the sort of levels of fandom or, you know, importance as, you know, the Indian national team. But I don't think that's true, that quite quickly with these franchises that, you know, Indian cricket fans chose their side and then started to follow them as assiduously and in some cases as fanatically as they do the national side. And so the importance of these fixtures shouldn't be underestimated. And I think part of that is that I think there is a sense in which the IPL is sort of the testing ground of players before they might ascend to the national side, especially in white ball cricket, obviously, in a way that is sort of in a package that is palatable to people who have to work, that sort of the four-day Ranji Trophy cricket would not be. And so, you know, you can get home, you can in prime time every night watch an IPL fixture, or you can go along. I remember being very surprised by how inexpensive the cheapest ticket was. It was sort of a fraction of one New Zealand dollar to get in, the cheapest ticket. So there wasn't the proportion of Indian cricket fans who could find IPL accessible was very, very high. And the experience at the ground was sort of unlike anything I'd experienced here because of the cheerleading and the very loud music and the drums. And I mean, it's kind of some of the things that we experience of Indian cricket fans here, but just much more overwhelming for a 20-over evening context.
Kia ora, Duncan Grieve here, managing editor and host of another spin-off podcast you should subscribe to if you haven't already. It's called The Fold, and it's about one of my all-time favourite topics, one I've been reporting on and obsessing over for some years now, the chaotic but incredibly exciting and fun New Zealand media industry and scene. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts, and join me for in-depth analysis and interviews with some of the most influential and interesting players in New Zealand's media.
I love the tournament as well because of the quality. Like, it's sort of like an extended All-Star weekend.
Indeed, yeah.
And it's not something you have in cricket in the same way that the NBA or the English Premier League or takes sort of precedence. And having all those players together, I think, is wonderful. And it's been such good cricket this season.
Well, including some really
close games.
Including some players who have retired from international cricket, right? You know, so Chris Gayle, I think he could still be playing when he's 50 if he wanted to.
Shane Watson keeps going.
Yeah. I mean, and it just, I agree. It just has this this sense of all of these giants of the game playing together. I also think about that in the context of New Zealand's players. So Kyle Jameson, you know, who he has next to him in the dressing room, you know, getting to spend time with Kohli and de Villiers, this can't help but, you know, make him mature as a cricketer in something that would never happen in any other cricketing context.
Well, I do wonder as well if there's an element of, I mean, thinking about how some people in New Zealand get about the America's Cup, where it's like all of the best sailors in the world are absolutely desperate to come here and participate in this competition that we absolutely love. And, well, I don't personally, but, you know, some people do, so that's fine. With the IPL, I wonder if there's anything for Indian cricket where there's a lot of pride tied up in the fact that the best players in the world are absolutely desperate to come and play in their tournament, as opposed to it being sort of just a domestic tournament. It's one where they can really take their pick of the absolute top players in the world on a sort of playing field in which, Indian cricket really holds the cards, as it were.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely something to that. You know, we've seen in the last 10, 15 years the real coming of age of the Indian cricket team. You know, Indians, this country of a billion people, have had to see other much smaller countries, including their rivals Pakistan, but also the West Indies, sort of ascend to these great heights in international cricket. And now Indian cricket fans feel, rightly, that their side across all formats is the best in the world, and that they have this sort of, they've had this coming of age moment. And part of that is being able to, I don't want to use the word dictate the terms, but, you know, really strongly influence the terms of international cricket. Part of that is the IPL, but other parts of it are that, you know, a very significant proportion of the world events, whether it's the, you know, 50 over World Cup or the T20 World Cup, will be played in India, because India is the centre of the cricketing world. And so some of these sort of negative connotations, I think, that come outside of India about the, you know, strong influence that the BCCI has over international cricket decision making, is sort of viewed the opposite way round in India, that India is now finally getting its just desserts as this cricketing superpower, something that it should have had earlier. You know, it won the World Cup the first time round in 1983, but it took quite a long time from then until, you know, getting to this place where it could feel like it was, you know, absolutely at the top of the pack.
Oh yeah, and I think it's fair enough for people in other countries to be uneasy about the power of the BCCI, I think, but it's also absolutely true that if you if you put every single cricket fan in the world in a line, you'd probably be two thirds through it before you got out of India as a country, you know. It's one of those things where they do have the power, in part because of weight of numbers, and that's sort of fair enough in a way.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're a diplomat in your day-to-day life. Has cricket ever come in handy for your job?
Oh, cricket was massively handy for me on my India posting.
I was going to ask, did you get picked for that by MFAT specifically because you're a huge cricket nerd as well?
Well, like, I think that may have been part of it. I hope that I have some other skills that help get me over the line, but that was probably three quarters of it. But I just think, you know, diplomacy very much is about, you know, breaking ice with people that you don't know and getting them talking with you and interested in you and in New Zealand. And by far, well, what I found was that by far the simplest way of doing that with I would say most Indians that I came into contact with professionally was to talk to them about cricket. And so I think just that sort of, you know, that commonality, you know, if you think about, you know, what do I have in common with these people that I'm trying to influence or interact with? For a New Zealander in India, there are a few things as helpful as cricket, because cricket is a language that's spoken by a very large proportion of the population through different social classes, different professions. And if you were to drop me into, my previous posting had been in the United States, drop me in there, and what's my point of connection? It's not going to be cricket, but it isn't obvious immediately when you just look at someone and you know they're American, what is the thing that I can connect with that person? But so I think that was helpful. There was also, I mean, the IPL aspect to it was very interesting too, as I think that the IPL, as well as the Black Caps becoming a better side, were very helpful in this regard as well. There are lots of New Zealand cricketers who are very well known in India, and the likes of McCullum and Stephen Fleming, the folks who have been coaches as well as captains, you just meet a whole lot of people who are interested in talking about that. And then you try and obviously connect that to, you know, the actual business reason that you need to talk to them. And then in terms of my next role coming up, opening our High Commission in Sri Lanka, I think that's the case too. I spent quite a bit of time in Sri Lanka on my last posting because we were responsible for Sri Lanka from Delhi. And there are in some ways a lot more commonalities between New Zealand and Sri Lanka than New Zealand and India, because we're much similar sizes. We're both island nations. We both sort of view ourselves as upstart cricketing nations who at various points in our histories have been able to, you know, reach the pinnacle of cricket. Them obviously most famously in with the Cricket World Cup victory in 1996, but then through the recent crop of players with Murali and then the fit of batsmen that they had. So they've been able to do that too. So and you know, we're small countries with very big neighbours. So I think there is a lot in there that'll be useful as we open the High Commissioner in Sri Lanka too.
Well, even as a tourist, it opened up huge opportunities for me in both India and Pakistan, where I was constantly wearing my 1992 Cricket World Cup shirt. I'd be rolling around in Pakistan and people were just shouting out to me wanting to talk about Imran Khan. And and then in India, I was wearing my Black Caps shirt during I'd gone to follow one of the tours there. And I was in a restaurant wearing my Black Caps shirt and a group of people thought I was a player. And they started lining up for autographs, and
the did you give them?
Longer and longer. I just went with it. I just was signing away.
I'm genuinely wondering if you're going to retell that particular anecdote on every single episode.
Every single one.
It's so good. It's so good.
And the office twice a week.
Yeah. So when you're in Sri Lanka, how excited are you to watch drawn test matches where 15 wickets fall across 5 days?
Oh, you know, I've been very interested in that match because the grounds people are getting a lot of heat for producing this for producing this dead pitch, and I guess we don't see it that often anymore that people kind of get shocked by it. I don't know. I think people need to maybe chill out a little bit about pitches which are dead or which are too lively. You know, there was all of that controversy over the two. Pitches in Ahmedabad in the England-India series and how
that was just atmosphere nonsense, wasn't that?
I guess I kind of feel like you have a spectrum of pitches. Some of them are going to be, you know, really at the dead end of the spectrum. Some of them are going to be the real lively end. And you obviously wouldn't want too much of either of those two extremes. So long as they're reasonably rare, I think I'm pretty relaxed about it. I think there's also this sort of strange idea that sort of a draw is a bad result. I'm not sure that I agree with that. I think sometimes draws can be super exciting. We probably all remember various valiant attempts by New Zealand number 11 batsmen to save games against teams that were much better than us, right? And if we are successful in that, we get a sort of a valiant draw. And that's kind of like an awesome test match in a way. So I think, if anything, I think pitches have probably moved too much in the we must get a result direction than the lifeless one. You know, draws are pretty rare now. I think I worked out at some point, I think that they're sort of somewhere in the region of four times less likely to happen now than they were in the 1970s.
Do you mean one of those like bore draw kind of games where we're much less likely to see them now?
Yeah, we're much less likely to see them now because part of it is that batsmen are much more attacking now than they used to be in Test cricket, right? And some of it also is that there are more sort of one-sided Test matches between, I don't know, Bangladesh and India, although they don't happen that often. But it's also, that I just think that there has been this pressure on groundsmen not to produce pitches which lead to results like we saw or lack of results like we saw in Kandy this week.
I thought Nathan Lyon made a really good point after the England-India test at Ahmedabad where he was like, if this had been a green-seeming wicket that led to a team scoring less than 100.
Yeah.
It would have been celebrated as exciting.
Yes.
As, you know, giving the power balance back to the bowler. But I think, you know, because it was in India and it was a spinning pitch, you know.
Well, we have to remember the last time that we beat India in a test series in New Zealand, which was the last one. I don't think India scored much more than 200 in a single innings in their test match, and that wasn't just because we bowled really well, although we did. It was because the two pitches that were prepared for the Indian side were quite unlike what they used to. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I'm saying if you're comfortable with that kind of thing, you should also be comfortable that from time to time there'll be the pitches like we saw in Ahmedabad.
I think it's a uniquely beautiful part of cricket as well. It's not, yeah. You know, when you play rugby, it's not like you prepare a really long grass deck if you've got slow backs or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a bit of an even playing field there.
One thing that not stresses me out but causes me some anxiety is what kind of pitch we're going to get in Southampton in June. Because I think the result could very much turn on whether it's a pitch more the liking of our bowlers than their bowlers.
So I've heard a lot of things about Southampton.
Yeah.
From, you know, some days it's a dust bowl, some days it's a reasonably fair wicket.
Yeah.
Who actually knows what the Southampton pitch usually is like?
Well, the tricky thing about it is that with Test cricket, at least, there have been very few Test matches there, sort of fewer than 10. It certainly seems to be that as the season goes on, it becomes more spin friendly, and sort of June is sort of halfway between the start and the end of the English season. So I think, and we saw actually in Southampton recently that there was some very very energetic and successful fast bowling there as well. So I think all of that adds up to that it's not as predictably sort of a green seam friendly wicket as Lord's would have been. So there's more uncertainty, but I don't think we know really enough yet to know what we might get, which is why it's a source of anxiety.
I was excited to see Kyle Jamieson do a Glenn McGrath impersonation on the Lord's Slope, but
yeah, that was good.
Not well, to happen.
He still might if you know, depending on what happens with the IPL, he may get to England in time.
No, but he's not going to be at Lord's.
Is that guaranteed now?
Yeah.
Ah, I see. Right. Right. Well, that's a shame.
Oh, but you mean? I guess it depends how early they leave, but they still need to do a long quarantine period, don't they? When they get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very long.
At what point does cricket diplomacy will Grant or Jacinda be calling up the groundskeeper at Southampton asking for a green deck? Because I'm sure the Indian Prime Minister wouldn't be afraid of getting involved.
Well, I don't think that New Zealand has a minister more obsessed with the Black Caps than Grant Robertson. So, you know, I think that he'll be taking close personal interest in this question. He did, you know, famously fly to London for the ill-fated Cricket World Cup final. So yeah, so but maybe you should write him a letter.
Apologised.
just on that point, generally though, politics and cricket do appear to be a lot more closely intertwined in some of the countries that you've worked in compared to New Zealand. Is that would you say that's a fair perception?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the we know from our own history, right, that there have been times when the New Zealand government has tried to influence sporting bodies to act in particular ways or not act in particular ways. We saw that with Muldoon in the Springbok tour. But I think I think certainly with South Asia, whether you're talking about Bangladesh, India, Sri Lanka, that the cricketing boards are closer to the political system than than New Zealand cricketers, say. And so that's... I don't think that that's that surprising, given how central they are to the cultures of those countries. And I think they sort of all of them will have started as being essentially part of the government, and then sort of become more and more removed. But they remain. You know, certain appointments are made by politicians. There are certain powers that are given under legislation, certainly in Sri Lanka, to act for Sri Lanka cricket if necessary. So, yeah, that's still very much a part. And I recall, I mean, I don't remember the exact issues, but I recall when living there that the sort of call on politicians to take actions for with sporting bodies was quite strong. It was felt that look, none of this is surprising, I don't think, really, because these are teams which represent the country. You know, they're not just some random team that plays a sport and that goes out into the world. They do claim to represent the country. So I don't think it's that surprising that there's sort of this desire to keep it reasonably close.
And you see a lot of cricketers graduate into politics as well. You know, Imran Khan.
You certainly do, yeah.
Sachin Tendulkar. Most New Zealand cricketers become real estate agents.
Yeah, lots of India has an upper house to which politicians can be appointed, and lots of former politicians sort of get appointed to the upper house, and then they may run to be run for election as an MP to the lower house. I think Gautam Gambhir is a BJP member of parliament, as an example. Again, this is not surprising. I kind of find it surprising that this has never happened in New Zealand to a great extent, you know, that a really famous, beloved sports person hasn't thought, you know, this should be my next career.
One of the most incredible examples of that maybe was when All Blacks winning captain David Kirk went for
right.
a National Party pre-selection and the local members said, nah, we'd rather have... I can't even remember who it was.
Yeah.
This guy, basically, yeah.
Have we had any sports people graduate into the...
Lewis O'Wall?
Yeah, Lewis O'Wall would probably be the most successful sports person, to be in our band.
So with the sort of stats that you crunch, a big theme of it does seem to be that the stats don't always match the perceptions of the actually existing teams, as it were. So, I mean, this is not one that you've necessarily done before, but based on that sort of analysis, who do you reckon right now is the most underrated or overrated team in international cricket?
Oh, that's really interesting. I think maybe Pakistan. I mean, it depends on about whose perceptions you're talking about, but I kind of feel like there's somewhat of a perception in New Zealand because Pakistan hasn't had a successful tour here for a while.
For a long time.
And, you know, they haven't been able to play cricket at home for a long time, although it's really great development that they now can do or they now are doing. And I just think they have the makings of a really good team. You know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility they could win the T20 World Cup. I just think on both sides of the coin, batsmen and bowlers, that they've got some pretty impressive bowlers. But I sometimes hear, you know, Pakistan sort of put in the same category as sort of West Indies, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh's teams that are easy to beat at the moment. And I absolutely don't accept that. In terms of sort of overrated, I think in Test cricket that both England and Australia are overrated. And I don't. I'm not saying that they're bad sides by any means, but you know, if you look at their performance over the last, you know, 3 to 5 years, they're just nowhere near. Their numbers are nowhere near as good as New Zealand's, or even better than New Zealand India's. And yet, I think because they are these sort of historical dominant. These historically powerful teams in world cricket, that everyone just assumes, well, the big three are the best three in some sense, but I don't think that's true. I think India is clearly the best of the three, of those three teams. And then after that, you know, Australia and England can be competed with by quite a range of other teams.
It feels good, quite good saying that, eh? I like when England and Australia are overrated.
Yeah.
Well, partly it's just because a very large proportion of the people who write about cricket internationally or are journalists or broadcasters or whatever are English or Australian or Indian, right? So there's just like this huge focus on those three teams, and which I think is sort of out of kilter with their actual performances in recent times.
And they
times.
Play disproportionately large amounts of top level cricket as well, I guess. They have more test matches against better teams, and
that is something that people have said about New Zealand's place in the World Test Championship, that we didn't, I mean, the argument goes that we didn't win enough big matches to deserve a spot in this final. I mean, what do you reckon about that?
That kind of thing, I mean, that thing sort of makes me crazy. You know, we beat India, the best side in the world, by the rankings and the numbers, 2-0. We beat England, although it wasn't counted towards the World Test Championship, which is the other side that's put forward as the one of the great teams. We beat them at home as well. I mean, I think one of the things is that, and this I see this with New Zealand cricket fans a lot too, is because we had that extremely disappointing series in Australia, and lots of New Zealanders sort of benchmark a team with how well have they done against Australia, that they're just very reluctant to view this cricket side, this current Black Caps side, as a very good team. Because what they remember is those three quite painful test matches that we saw on the other side of the Tasman. But I think part of that was to sort of like single in on a single series and and ignore everything else is kind of ridiculous. I mean, if you were to do that, you would say, well, Australia doesn't deserve to be in the World Test Championship final because they got beaten 2-1 at home by India, and it wasn't even India's best side. It was sort of, you know, their 12th to 20th best players, you know. So sort of if you go down the track of judging teams by their worst moment, nobody would be in the final. India also wouldn't be in the final because we smashed them 2-0, you know, we smashed them 2-0 here, right? So there are no perfect teams at the moment. The West Indies in the 1980s were a close to perfect team. The Australia in the 2000s were a close to perfect team. There isn't one now. There are all of these sort of flawed sides, and I certainly don't accept that New Zealand is more flawed than Australia or England are.
All right. Well,
I think it's making world cricket really fun at the moment as
exactly.
well.
Exactly.
I love it. There is no like super team. There's all every time you walk out, there's you've got a chance.
I've got one more question for you, Michael, and it's a difficult one. We'll say you're a year into your job as the High Commissioner for Sri Lanka. The Black Caps are on tour, you're at the ground, the Black Caps have an injury crisis, and they say, are there any New Zealand passport holders who are in the crowd right now? What do you do? Do you put your hand up?
Oh, I think I maybe offer up my three-year-old son. He'll be four at that stage, but he's very excited about cricket, and I think he probably my skill levels are still higher than his at the moment, but I think our lines are going to cross at a certain point during the time in Sri Lanka. So hopefully, when that moment comes, he'll be ready.
Well, it has been it's been fantastic having you on, and as I said before, really, really enjoying your articles. Hopefully, you can still keep them coming for us after you start having to actually represent the country again.
To me, it sounds like all diplomats do is talk shit about cricket. So
yeah, that's exactly.
It really plays well into his role as chief statistician of the spin-off.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually.
They feel mutually agreeable roles.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
No problem. Anytime. And
Let's get the beer spot in touch with Jimmy Neesham as well, because this Liberty Lekker Brew Pilsner is far better than any Corona I've ever had. So big shout out to the beer spot coming on Huge board shout. To look after the off-spin. We really appreciate it. I'm worried about what it's going to mean for the all-nighters during the World Test Championship. Because
it's going to enhance them.
Well, previously it was a coffee sponsor, which made a bit more sense, and a beer sponsor. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
Overnight beer drinking, good times.
Oh, we'll love it. We'll absolutely love it. That is The Offspin. I'm Alex, he's Simon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Kia ora.
For Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-Off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-Off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.